This is Karen Brewster, and today is September 4th, 2025, and I'm here with Doug Kachetag, who is from Unalakleet, but we are here in Anchorage at the Alaska Native Medical Center to talk today about the Iditarod Historic Trail. So, Doug, before we get to the trail, can you tell me just a little bit about yourself? Did you grow up in Unalakleet?
Yeah, yeah. I was born in Unalakleet, June 15th, 1947. And Alaska was just a territory then. So we had no fishing game, but our grandparents taught us to preserve food and always get just what you need, not more than what you need. Mm-hmm. So we live by their rules and laws, and we always have abundance of fish and everything else. So, and I grew up amongst dogs. My dad had dogs. They were necessary to get your ice, wood, everything.
Right.
Hunting and everything. They were necessary. And I kept them. One breed and carried on. Also, in 1971, Joe Renton Sr. went to Unalakleet to buy fish for, I forgot which fish company. And I worked with him. And all that summer, all he talked about was, do you think sled dogs could run from Anchorage to Nome? And after fishing closed in September, we cleaned up the fish plant and he was going to spend the winter there with his dogs. But he asked me too many questions about whether the dogs could run from Anchorage to Nome. And I told him one morning, go check for mail. And they did as soon as he walked out. I got on the phone, called the airlines, and made him reservations to come back to Anchorage and back to Kinnick. And when he came back, I was packing his bag. And he said, what the hell do you think you're doing? I said, Joe, you took the small town, one small cafe, two small stores. You can't start no race here. But you're going back to Anchorage and start your race. When you get home, settle down for about a week, then go to Anchorage. When you get to Anchorage, call me. Let me know you're there. So he did, and I said, what am I supposed to do? I said, well, walk around the streets, you know, talk to people, put the bug in their ear, beg for money. And after a week of doing that, he said, I'm tired, I got to go back to Kinnick and rest. I said, yeah, when you go back to Anchorage, let me know. So when he came back, he said, I'm back in Anchorage, what do I do now? I said, you go to the TV stations and radio stations and promote your race. Get them talking about it on the air. Mm-hmm. And so he did that. And he said, I'm done with them. We got that over the air now. And he said, what am I going to do now? I said, you go see the big oil companies, doctors, lawyers, pilots, big restaurants, big stores, and give them the idea of the race and ask them for sponsorship. And he did that. And in November, he called me up and said, Doug, it's a go. I raised $50,000. We could start the race now.
Wow.
I said, Joe, wait. You can't yet. We got to hire people that know the trail. The trail hasn't been used since mail run days. and it's all grown over. So we need people that know the trail to reopen the trails. Mm-hmm. I'll work on it, this side of it, the northern part, get it open by calling the state and whoever could help. And I'll hire 3-4 guys to do it. So I got funding from Department of Transportation.
Huh.
And I hired my dad, his friend, 2 friends, and they went up. The first year they went to halfway. Them snowshoes back then were real heavy and they get stuck all the time.
Yeah.
And so that really slowed them down. And there was a lot of snow back then. So they came back, they said they make it halfway, they're done for the year. It's going to start getting too warm. I said, okay. And next year I got more funding for them. And they took off. And they made it all the way to Carlton just before the dog mushers. And then spent a couple of days up there and came home. And the trail was in.
So that was the spring of 72?
72, yeah.
Was the first race?
73.
73,
March
okay.
3rd, 1973.
Okay.
They started here at Mulcahy. They ran from here to Kinnick.
Right.
Kinnick was the first checkpoint. Joe and I were up there drinking coffee at Kinnick. And he said, boy, Doug, I hate to tell you this. Garrett, what do you do wrong this time? He said, I only got trailed to Willow. Oh, that blew me. And I said, that's only 5 miles from here. What you gonna do? And I thought about turning them around at the lake and bringing them back to Anchorage. But I thought about the critics. They said, you guys are crazy. You guys are crazy to start a race that they can't conquer.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, I'm going to show you guys it can be done. So I said, Joe, you know, you got Fort Rich right over here. Go over there and go talk to the general. Mm-hmm. Beg, cry, do anything to have him send a squad out on the bivouac training, at least to McGrath. So, and if he has any questions, tell him to give me a call. I flew for a general while I was in the Army. I know how to talk to them. And that general says, pilot, I ain't talking to those guys. I hate them. I'll have squad there 6 o'clock in the morning. Give them the coordinates and send them on their way. So we got the Army.
So how did you have the idea to go ask the Army?
I was just fresh out of the Army.
Okay.
And I knew what they could do if you talk to the right people. And talking to a general and make him a little bit mad, which makes him do what you want.
Well, I can see how you tell him, I bet you can't do that, right? They're going to say, no, you're wrong.
Yep.
All right.
So when the squad got to McGrath, the captain called the general saying, sir, we learned a lot during this. Can we go all the way to Nome? And the general said, I'm going to have a plane fly you gas and food today. Hmm. And to McGrath, to Galena, and to Unifleet. And tell that SOB Doug, thank you. See, we had a checkpoint at Old Woman, 40 miles above Unifleet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there in a tent. And the captain, when they came, told me all about it. He said, you know, I personally want to thank you because this is the best bivouac training we've ever been on.
Yeah. And I think most people don't know about that. I know about it because Dick Mackey told me about it. You know, and I've read an account from Joe, but I never heard of that army group doing that.
Yeah.
And they used snow machines?
Huh? Yeah, they used snow machines. Back then they had a big, wide snow machine with one ski in front and two tracks in the back. And they had a pulley in front. So when they got stuck, they had a really huge anchor that they put into the ground. And that when they start pulling, it digs into the ground and pull them out.
Okay, because that's how they avoided getting stuck like you guys.
Yeah. So. And then they had smaller snow machines. That, when they got to places where the snow was real deep, they used the smaller ones to break trail.
Okay. Did they use snowshoes too?
Yeah, they used snowshoes too. You had to.
Yeah. How long did it take them?
It took them 20 days. 20 days.
From
here.
From Anchorage?
No, from Kinnick.
Right.
From Kinnick to Anchorage,
Nome.
Yeah, they got there not too long before the front runner.
Right.
That front runner ran his dogs with just the qualified material he needed and nothing else.
Right. And back then it took longer than the race nowadays, yeah.
Everybody else had sleds that were just round. A lot of dog feed, a lot of stuff, unnecessary stuff. But we didn't know, you know.
Right.
We're used to camping. That's how our sleds look when you go camping.
Yep. You take everything with you.
Yeah.
So when Joe said, I want to do this race from Anchorage to Nome, what was your response?
It can be done. I'm going to go show you dogs that could do it. I brought them to my dog lot. And I said, you see these dogs? They could do it. They could do it in 10 days. And so he said, well, what do we do to get it started? I just ignored him from there for till late September when I sent him back here.
Uh-huh.
And, well, he started, he advertised the race in October, late fall of 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And March 3rd, 1973. And there were 35, 37 people signed up. And 30 some made it.
Yeah.
And that was fun.
So, how did you know about the trails to make the connections?
I asked the old people, and they said to hire my dad, his friend, and one, his other friend. They know the trail. So I did. So the old people used to talk about the mail run days. They talk about the mail run days, how they...
Oh, mail run, yeah.
Yeah. And they said the trail's there. You just got to open it up. You take axes and saws and cut all the brush.
So people weren't using their trails?
No.
So you hired your dad. That would be Fred Kachetag?
Yeah.
And your brother, Fred Kachetag Jr.?
Junior, that was the second year.
Oh.
The first year was, the first year they went up was my dad, Fred Kachetag, his friend Raymond Towarik.
Okay.
And his other friend, Wasili Ika.
Okay.
Wasili Ikon was the elder.
Okay.
And he knew the trail, so he just pointed point, you know.
So did you guys use those trails for hunting and traveling around?
Yeah. Right now they're well used. The Caltech people start coming down to trap and start visiting Unicade again.
Oh.
Yeah, you see, there used to be an Indian village 7 miles upriver from Unicade. And those people moved all to Caltech.
Okay. Yeah, I know there was that Portage Trail from Caltech to Unicade.
Yeah.
And they stopped using that?
No, it's always used. You know, they had trail only 12 miles out of Caltech.
Okay.
For trapping. And from 12 Mile Creek there, down to Old Woman, nobody used that.
Okay.
And there was always a lot of snow. In 1974, Victor Cadogan and I opened a trail by dog team. And it took 1 week to get to Caltech and 10 hours to get home. We slept in our sleds all 60 below all the time. And I ordered reflectors. No, Joe sent reflectors, red reflectors, to put on trees. And that first time I was going to walk over, and I sunk.
Up to your neck?
That deep in the snow. Lucky I was hanging on to my sled. I couldn't pull myself up, so I told my dogs to go. They went slow. I said, go slow. They pulled me out, they got on the sled, went back around the tree, stopped, stand on my sled, pack a reflector up. And in 1980s, you could see that reflector way up on the tree, trails way down here.
Oh, yeah. That's, the difference in snow level.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
So who did you do that, the 1974 trail trip with? Who was that?
Victor Cotogan. K-O-T-O-N-G-A-N.
K-O-T-O-N-G-A-N. G-A-N. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. We did that for 4 years, maybe, using dog team because we didn't have no snow machines.
So you reopened it every year?
Yeah.
Okay.
For 5 years.
And you did it with dog team, wow.
Yeah.
So before 72, when the race was starting, or 73, before all this, was that Caltech to Unalakleet trail, when did it stop being used?
During trail runners quit.
Okay.
When they started flying airplanes. And that's when the mail runners quit. Then after that, it just grew over. Nobody used it.
Right. So what was that like, going and opening that up again?
A lot of work. Lots of work. When we started using snow machines, we'd get stuck so bad you'd look up at the stars. And what I'd have to do is shovel underneath my snow machine, tilt it over, go cut some brush or trees, whichever place I'm at, put them under the track and fly out of there.
Oh. And you cut all the brush back by hand?
Yeah. We had no chainsaws. We had only hand saws and axe.
Wow.
That's all. We didn't know about chainsaws back then.
So how many miles of trail did that make that you opened up?
On the old trail, it was 100.
Wow.
Going through the trail that the Army put in. Back during World War I or II.
Oh, there was an old army trail?
Yeah. That, well, we followed the old army trail. The mail trail was all grown over.
Oh, so what was the army trail?
They put a telegraph line from St. Michael all the way to Fairbanks.
Oh, the Wamcats.
Yeah.
The Wamcats line?
Yeah.
Okay. And that was different than the mail trail.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing that the local people had their own trail system.
Yeah, they didn't travel far, maybe 10, 15 miles at the most.
Oh, okay.
For trapping.
Okay.
They didn't have to go far to trap.
Right.
You know, there was no vehicles running around, no people running around. So they crossed from one side to the other quite a ways down. And they did a really good trapping close by.
Uh-huh.
And now there's so many different vehicles and outboard motors and snowshoes and airplanes.
Yeah.
You got to go way up into the hills.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What about for hunting? Did you have to go very far?
No. Just right across the river. Back in when we were territory, geese would fly right over our house or any kind of bird fly over. We'd knock them down right there.
Right.
And to go camping, just to go camping, we'd go out down along the coast and camp out.
Okay.
To hunt. And,
for seal hunting?
Yeah.
What about for fishing? Did you go upriver?
All summer long. We'd leave, and as soon as the fish show up, we'd head up, go make camp, and spend the whole summer putting away fish. Never went to town.
Yeah. Sounds nice.
Because we didn't have no motors. Our motors were too slow, burned too much gas. We couldn't afford it. And late fall, we'd drift so many miles down and start the motor one way about 2-3 miles away.
Yeah. Well, but that trail between Unalakleet and Caltag, before it was a mail trail, was it used? So the Indians and the Inupiaq would...
Just right there near town.
Okay.
Not between... Not
you
from,
guys didn't...
No, from...
interact with each other.
Somewhat. But they were always fighting.
Yeah.
And when they were ready to leave, our runner was Shafter Tshaubik. He ran the chief from... That Indian village sent down a message to have our chief, have Shafter run to St. Michael Stebbins, tell them they want to have a big powwow on the sandbar, and to Shaktalik and Koyuk. So all the chiefs from those villages came to Unalakleet, and they all went up to that sandbar where the Indians lived and had a week-long powwow. And after a week-long powwow, they gathered all their stuff and moved up overland up to Swarovski, right below the Swarovski tree line, and made out to the left side of the trail, made their homes. And you could see their mounds where they lived.
Huh.
And they stayed there for so long. From there, they moved up river and stayed at the in the river for some time. Then from there they moved up to Whaleback and had it lived there for a number of years. Then from there they moved from Old Woman to between Old Woman and 10 Mile along the riverbank, and for their houses were there's a big dip where the main Khatibik was.
Uh-huh.
And from there, they moved to Caltech. And my friend's mom, we were sitting there talking. She said, I was a little girl when those Indians moved up. And we used to tease the Eskimo Indians. And lo and behold, I married one of them, son of a bitches.
So, in Unalakleet, do you consider yourselves Inupiaq?
Inupiaq, yeah.
Inupiaq, okay.
But now there's all kinds of people there.
Yeah, right. I just wanted to make sure I was using the right term.
Yeah, our ancestors came down from Kobuk River.
Oh, okay.
And they settled, some settled there in Unalakleet, some down at Gulsovia, 20 miles down. And it was my grandparents that settled in Gulsovia.
Oh.
And in later 1800s, they moved back to Unalakleet.
I remember I interviewed somebody who talked about a fox farm. A fur farm on that
mink
trail?
Mink farm.
Yeah, between Caltech and...
Yeah, mink farm.
Okay.
It was owned by the Laplanders. When they quit reindeer herding, they built that mink farm.
But that was close. It was closer to Caltech, right?
Closer to Unalakleet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. But that... So to get there, the trail, you just went back and forth from Unalakleet?
Yeah. Yep. They had cabins built here and there for the mail trail.
Right.
So that they could spend night there.
Right.
It took them about 4 or 5 days to get to Caltech with an open trail.
From Unalakleet?
Yeah.
Okay.
I talked with my neighbor. He was a Laplander.
Uh-huh.
He was a mail trail runner.
Oh, yeah.
And he said he decided to try wolf dogs. He said, never get that kind of dogs. You can't fall near them. They'll chew you up.
Oh, half wolf, half dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's never...
I was just going to ask you something. Oh, the buildings. You talked about the cabins for the...
Yeah.
When you guys were working on the new Iditarod Trail in the 70s, were any of those buildings still around?
There were. They fell down. The roofs had fell down. They were rotten. So we couldn't stay in them. We had to sleep outdoors in our sleds.
Oh. You didn't have a tent, any wall tents?
No, not when you're breaking trail. Too much weight.
Oh.
Because you have to carry your own dog feed.
Right.
And the sled's full of dog food.
What about any of the old roadhouses or anything? Nothing on the trail?
There was how long is that 22 mile? 10 mile old woman and whaleback. That's how often they for the mail trail.
Oh, those were the cabins for
Yeah.
Them. So those weren't roadhouses, those were just cabins.
For the mail carriers.
Right. And did they have dog barns?
No.
No.
They didn't need them. They just spent one night there.
Okay.
So.
Wasn't there a roadhouse someplace with a dog barn? In either in Unalakleet or not too far from there?
Not that I know of.
Oh, okay.
Because I traveled up and down that trail for 40 years.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm asking. You would know.
No.
No, nothing, huh?
Nothing. Unless the people that lived in Old Woman built one.
Um, Yeah, I'm trying to think of the time period. I'd heard about something, but now I can't think of the...
They used to have a cable bridges across Swarovski and Old Woman. I don't know whatever happened to those. Some mail carriers would go through them because the snow was too deep.
Oh.
And there's water. It's just scary, just moving around.
Oh, the bridge would swing?
Yeah.
Oh. That's pretty scary. I was thinking about, just looking at this article, the last people to use that portage trail. You had talked about previously Eli and Missouri Stanley, Franklin Madros, and Junior Solomon.
Yeah, they were trapping at 10 Mile Creek. And they got dropped for beaver. And they, when they get a lot, they come down to Young Creek and trade beaver skin for a poke of seal oil.
Oh.
The poke of seal oil is a real big, carried a lot of seal oil.
Right.
And after they rest up a couple of days, they take off and go back to Coltag and quit for the year.
Yeah, so that was before, what was that, like in the 50s? Or
in the 50s, when I was a little boy.
So that trail still was usable back then?
Yeah.
Huh? Okay. That's pretty good. Yeah, that was a seal poke that was a seal skin made into a poke.
Yeah.
So that is a lot of seal oil.
Yeah, that's they always used that back in the old days.
Yeah.
I remember I used to have to go out there and get seal oil from the seal poke.
So the other people that helped with the trail, Chuck Sagunik?
Yeah, okay. On 1972-73, I hired my dad, Raymond Tawar, Chuck Sagunik, and my brother, Fred Kittag Jr., to go open it all the way to Coltag.
Okay.
And Department of Transportation, I told them, just send them the check, don't send it to me. Send them the check so that they know they'll be paid. So that's what they did. They agreed to do that. And they opened it up to. It took them 2 weeks, 3 weeks. It took them a while anyway. And then they made it to Coltag just before the front runners got there.
So to find that old trail and open it up again between Knick and Caltag, that was the Army group who did
that?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You guys just did Unalakleet to Caltag.
Yeah, and there was already a trail from Unalakleet to Shaktoluk because they traversed back and forth.
Okay. And then Shaktoluk to Nome.
Yeah, there was all the trail all the way to Nome.
Okay.
Because people made trails. They had the Covenant Church that used to have spring conferences, so they kept their trails open up there.
Okay. And I wondered if the people traveled more between the villages.
Yeah, yeah. Then when I did what I started, I just put over the air. Radio, I needed people to volunteer to check mushers in all my cousins along the trail. That's all, they all volunteered. Real proud, too.
Mm-hmm.
We were proud people. They were proud to be checkers back then.
Yeah. Yeah. And how did you get those guys to work on the trail itself?
I didn't have to. I just called them to see if there was trail. They said they always use it, so it's always open. And the Koyuk people, going across the bay, they'd put trees
right
into the ice because they travel. And They don't want, when it's stormy, you can't see.
Right.
So they follow the trees.
Right. But when you were going to brush out that trail with your dad and them, did you just ask people or did you put a call out?
Yeah, I put a call, but they're the only ones that were willing to do it.
Yeah.
Because the other people knew how tough it would be. It would be.
Yeah.
And so they had snow machines and them all just get stuck all the time.
Yeah, so how come they didn't use dog teams? They used snow machines?
Yeah. They quit running dogs and started using snow machines.
Oh. But when you did it with Victor, you guys used dog teams?
Yeah, yeah. Because we didn't have no snow machines.
Oh, okay.
And they wouldn't notice theirs.
Well, so how did you think of going to Department of Transportation?
I called around. There was one guy working right there in Unicrit for DOT.
Okay.
And he told me they could give you money if you ask them right. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And I did get it.
Do you remember how you asked them? What did you say?
I told them, I'm Doug Ketchday, trying to reopen the trails between Unicrit and Coltay for the purpose of the Iditarod Sled Dog Race that's coming up in March 3rd, 1973. And we need funding to hire men that know the trail to pay them so that they don't have to leave their family with nothing.
Right.
And so, okay, they'll do it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you could use it as a, you know, access to Caltag. It's a safety thing maybe. Yeah. That was smart.
And after the trail was open, all kinds of people start using it. Bikers, skiers, snowshoers, dog mushers.
Snow machiners.
Walkers. Everybody.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering how the local people felt about their, quote unquote, their trail, their land now being open to everybody.
They were happy. They could go back, go see where they grew up fishing. They could get on their snowshoe, go up and see it, all the way to Old Woman. They spent a lot of time going to Old Woman after it opened up.
Okay. So Old Woman was a traditionally used place?
Yeah, Old Woman, there was an old man and his wife living there trapping. The guy would go up river, up toward Coltay. The lady would come down, go down, and she was walking back to, and the old woman mountain collapsed, the snow collapsed and buried her.
Oh.
And he looked for her all winter, never found her until spring when it melted. And that's how it got its name, Old Woman. And ever since 1973, that old woman haunted all the mushers. Not all, some of them. And they always asked me, is there a ghost at Old Woman? I said, yeah, why? It bothered me all night last night. 1975, we did the rerun of the Serum Run. And Robert Nicholas from Coltay ran from Coltay to Old Woman. I was at Old Woman. And his friend was snowshoeing in front, walking down toward Old Woman River. And he ran into this woman, walking about 3-4 feet off the ground, real bright, lit, beautiful cuspuck. And she said she was beautiful. And he remembered, oh yeah, them old people told me not to look at her. put your head down and walk past her. So he did that. And they passed, she's 3 feet apart, they passed each other. And he just kept walking with his head down toward the old woman until he got to the creek where he finally looked around upon the trail and got to our camp there. We camped there for a week waiting for the serum. And when he walked in, his face was really scared, you know. I could tell. I said, sit down, have a cup of coffee, and tell me about it. He looked at me real hard, real hard. What do you mean, tell me about it? I said, you seen something. You seen something, and I want you to tell me. He said, how the hell you know? I said, just tell me, and I'll tell you what to do. So he told me, he said, he was snowshoeing along the trail, and he seen this woman coming up 3 feet off the ground, real bright, all lit up in different colors.
Wow.
Just beautiful. And he got so close, and he remembered the old timers in Caltech told him, if you see that, put your head down, don't look. So he did. If you look at her, he'd have gone crazy.
Oh.
And he did get a little crazy, a little bit, because he looked at her out from a distance.
Wow.
So every year, one guy running the editor was chopping wood there, and his hand flew out of his axe flew out of his hands and cut his dog.
Oh, it tumbled and it cut his dog. Woo.
And Mark Nordman and Jack Niggemeyer were managers then, and they didn't want to go up and tell him. So I went up this, I had to go up and tell him that he's disqualified. And that there was a plane coming in to pick up his dog so that they could take care of it down in Uruguay, the vets, a real long cut.
So he was disqualified because the dog was injured?
Yeah, yeah.
He couldn't just put the dog in the sled and keep going?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
It would have died.
Oh, okay.
So they picked it up and sewed it up and sent it to Anchorage.
So is Old Woman still a spot on the trail?
Yeah.
It was our first,
we had a checkpoint there in 1973 and 74. And because they needed a place to stop and eat and feed their dogs and rest. They needed a tent to rest in.
Right.
So in 1975, I told Joe, I can't get nobody down here usually to check. I have to just go up to Owen to put up a tent and chop a lot of wood so that they could have one place to go to. And so I stayed checker in Uruguay till I was for 40 years.
So they took out the Old Woman checkpoint. They just go Caltech to Uruguay, right?
Well, I always had a tent there before they built cabins.
Okay.
I put a tent there and they stayed there and made their own fire. There's a lot of wood cut up. And when half the mushes go through, I go back up, cut more wood, and go back.
So there's an emergency shelter there?
Not that. It had fallen down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they don't use that anymore, do they?
Huh?
Do they still use that?
Yeah. BLM built a cabin there right below the old woman.
Oh, okay.
mountain.
Okay.
They built a log cabin there. So that's been in use for years now.
Okay.
They go back every summer to redo it, you know.
Uh-huh.
Make sure it's still livable.
Uh-huh. So did you help BLM with any of those?
Yeah. Yep. As a matter of fact, I'm supposed to go visit them when I'm here.
Oh.
I never do.
So kind of things did you do with BLM?
Go up and clean the area, clean up, and put wood near the cabin.
Uh-huh.
Make sure there's gas for the gas lamp.
And then what about trail work? Did you do trail work for BLM?
Do what?
Trail maintenance and clearing. Once BLM kind of took over the trail.
Yeah.
Did you do work for them on the trail?
No, after they took over, I said, it's up to you guys now. I'm done.
Okay.
You guys got helicopters, you got boats, you got everything. I got nothing. So they said, okay.
I didn't know if maybe, did they hire you to work for them?
No, they just asked me as to volunteer.
Oh.
I don't know why, they make a lot of money.
So you didn't volunteer?
I did, I had to, you know. It was my obligation because of the Iditarod.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I felt obligated to clean it up.
Yeah, I was wondering if that part of the trail that you broke out in the 70s,
yeah.
Did you feel obligated to keep that open?
Yeah.
Kind of your trail?
Yep. Because we wanted to keep the Iditarod going. The second or third year, Joe called me up and said, Doug, I can't raise no money, so I'm going to mortgage everything I have.
Wow.
Everything I own, I'll mortgage. I said, it's a good idea, because once you do that, people will see that you're serious, and the money will start coming in. And he said, how do you know? I said, just believe me, Joe. So he did. He mortgaged his place, and after that, about December, money started flowing in. And he had a lot of money race time. He banked, just put it in the bank.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you run the race?
No.
You never ran it with your dog?
He sent me a check from one guy in Seattle to run the race. I wrote a note in the check. I sent it back to Joe. I said, Joe, I told you once, I won't ever run this race because I worked too damn hard getting it started. My dogs did. Ramey's got my breed there that his son uses.
Ramey Reddington?
Yeah. Ryan Reddington.
Ryan Reddington, yeah.
He's using that breed.
Oh.
And the other, Brent Dash, he had my other breed.
Who was that?
Brent Sash.
Oh, Brent Sash, yeah. You'd think somebody who worked so hard on the trail and getting the race started would want to run it. I mean, Joe did.
No.
Dick
no,
Mackey did.
Me.
Dan Seavey, all
not
those guys.
Me, not me.
No.
No way. Nope.
You were just like dog mushing around your country.
Yeah. I learned a lot running dogs. I went to one place where there's nothing but willows. I stopped my dogs and sitting there drinking coffee. Pretty soon the willows started fluttering. I looked and I said, okay, talk to me. So they started telling me to observe Mother Nature. Look when you're out in the ocean. If you're on an iceberg and you start going around in circles, look down in the water. Mm. See what you see. And I see a cyclone coming up. And I look north. A lot of wind coming. So that was 60 miles straight out.
Wow.
I pushed my boat out and ran toward home fast as I could.
Yeah.
By the time I got half a mile offshore, I was doing that number.
Oh, big waves.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I got behind one real big one. I couldn't climb it or do nothing, so I just stayed right behind it till it got to shore and I turned around and got in the mouth.
Wow.
That saved me, that big wave.
You kind of rode that, you sort of surfed that wave in.
Yeah.
Huh? Wow. But these willows, what were they telling you?
Huh?
The willows fluttering.
Like that, and their voice came up.
And what did it say?
Always observe Mother Nature. It'll teach you how to survive. Mm-hmm. It'll teach you what you need.
Uh-huh.
And teach you how to get it. And when you're in the ocean, you look.
You observe too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that taught me a lot about the weather.
So did you prefer using dogs than a snow machine?
Yeah, yep. Because they were quiet.
Uh-huh.
Quiet, and you could see everything.
And they're slower than a snow machine.
It's not much.
I guess your dog's probably not.
No. One lady used to, Eva Ryan, she used to go ice fishing up 20, 30 miles upriver. And she passed me on a flats going up. And she asked me, where are you going? I said, wherever you go, I'll be right behind you. And she just laughed and took off. And when I got up to where she was fishing, gee, you're already here? I just got done making a hole. You're already here.
She was on a snow machine?
She was on a snow machine.
Yeah. Well, and also, those first snow machines, as you say, didn't go so fast. And
yeah.
Dog team doesn't get stuck. No. Quite like the old machines.
Yep.
Yep.
Anyway, we fished her all day. I got a sack of trout, big trout, too. And she said, you want me to carry your fish home? I said, no. My dog's got to work right. I can't just let him come and go home empty.
Yeah.
She just laughed. No wonder your dog's just strong.
And was that fish for the dogs or fish for you?
Yeah, for both.
Oh, yeah.
Both. I kept the big ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you broke the trail out that first year, and you and your dad, they were clearing it by hand, how did they mark it?
They didn't. They just scraped the willows. Make sure you could see the scrape.
Like a slash on the... Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Or a break of willow on top.
Okay.
Because they had nothing else to mark it with.
Right.
And a lot of mushers complained about that first 10 years.
Really? It was 10 years before it got marked well?
Yeah.
Wow.
Before we could mark it real good.
Well, you said about Joe gave you reflectors to put up.
Yeah.
Then, so that was the first putting any kind of markers?
10th year they sent plastic, about 6-foot plastic to make tripods.
Okay.
But every spring they blow away.
Oh. And those came from BLM? Tripods?
Yep.
And so you guys from Unalakleet, you guys would go and put them out?
Yeah.
Okay. And did folks from Caltag come up the trail to do stuff, or was all...
Their trail is one way only. You can't get lost. One trail.
Uh-huh.
And it's going through trees and willows, so you can't get lost.
But did anybody from Caltag work on the trail, or was it
No, they didn't have to.
It was always you guys.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Okay. So do other people in Unalakleet do all the trail work like you do?
They don't have to anymore. I just not got the trail breakers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they got, I don't know how much snow machines leaving before the Iditarod.
Okay, I didn't know if guys from the communities did the trail breaking.
No,
it's they come all the way.
Yeah, they start here in Anchorage. They truck their snow machines to
Knicker.
Willow.
Willow, yeah.
And go from there. And that's been going on for 40 years or so.
Yeah. But before that, did the folks in the villages?
Just me and Duke. Victor.
You and Victor?
Yeah, nobody else wanted to do it. Too much work.
What about the other villages?
The villages, they make their own trail. They always travel between villages. Like on the Yukon, Caltech goes up. They got a last chance above Nulato, which is a liquor store. And not too far from there is Koyukuk. Koyukuk comes down. And Galena, once in a while, they go down to visit people at Koyukuk.
Yeah, and Galena and Ruby, that's a well-used trail.
Well-used, yeah.
Yeah.
So. And on the Yukon, you can go wide open.
Oh, yeah. It's a good way to get lost out there on the Yukon, right? So, did you, in 1978, the trail got designated as a historic trail.
Uh-huh.
Did you know anything about that when that was happening?
1978?
Uh-huh.
What about it?
The Iditarod Trail got designated as a National Historic Trail.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
It became worldwide. Because that's when people from different parts of the world started entering and running. So they renamed it the International because of different countries running.
Oh, that's why it became...
Yeah.
Yeah, but the trail itself got this federal designation, and that's how BLM got involved.
Yeah,
because they were put in charge of it.
Well, BLM got involved because from Swarovski up to Old Woman is a wild and scenic river.
Oh, okay.
And that's BLM land. So they have to take care of that land.
Right.
It's not because... of the Iditarods, because they of the wild and scenic river.
Right.
They want to make sure people don't build or damage any part of that trail.
Right. But when it got designated in 1978 as an official historic trail, BLM was then put in charge of the whole thing, from Seward all the way to Nome.
They might have, they do.
But that didn't affect you.
I never heard of them being in charge of the trail.
Right.
Never.
Well, did you remember Kevin Keeler?
Huh?
Kevin Keeler? Do you remember him?
Yeah.
BLM trail manager?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so he worked for BLM.
Yeah, but they weren't in charge. I hired volunteers that they just bought them snow machines.
Okay.
To open the trail up all the way to Nome.
Okay.
They call them the trail breakers.
Trail breakers, yeah.
And at the end, there's a trail sweep.
Right.
The trail sweep cleans up after the mushers.
Right.
And make sure, I used to have to score them a lot. They never do a good job.
Oh.
Anyway, I never heard of BLM being in charge. I know about that. Only reason it became internationally known is because of the amount of mushers that signed up from different countries.
Right.
Spain, France, England, Denmark.
Well, yeah, so for the trail itself, not the dog race, but the trail itself, the fact that it was historic, that didn't matter to you guys?
No, it didn't, no. It was there. It was there before.
Right.
And it's only because of the amount of people from foreign countries running.
Right.
That it's called that.
Okay.
So that the foreigners could know what they're getting into.
Right.
And we've had people from all over the world now.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance?
No. I don't know what they are.
Okay. Yeah, they're kind of a Friends of the Trail group. They support things, they promote the trail being protected and its history,
yeah.
And that's what this project is for. And so I just didn't know if you'd ever heard of them or had anything to do with them.
No.
I know that they helped fund one of the emergency shelters. I think it was out of McGrath.
Yeah, probably in between Nicolai and McGrath, or between McGrath and...
Yeah, I can't remember.
Maybe one of the trails after you pass the Cottonaw. It's wide open all the way to Ruby.
I don't remember, but I know they help.
I think it's between, might be at Iditarod. I think they built a new one there.
Okay. But they've never done anything with you guys in Unalakleet.
No. No, we never heard of them.
Okay. Did BLM ever do any public education or outreach with people in Unalakleet?
No. No, they stay where they're at, come over springtime and summer.
Uh-huh.
That's when the fish are there.
Yep. But you...
It's like a vacation for them.
Yeah. Do you remember Kevin Keeler, the trail manager?
Yeah, barely.
Do you remember how you knew him and what he did?
He asked me to watch O'Woon, the cabin.
Okay.
Take care of the cabin.
Okay. But BLM didn't pay you to do that?
No.
Did they pay for your gas, anything?
No.
Wow, okay.
Everything I did on the Iditarod came out of my pocket. When we first started, I spent a lot of my own money.
Yeah.
Starting the race. And when the mushers ran, they wanted stuff sent home. But they had no money to do that. So I send them home for them with my own money.
Wow.
And for that, I did that for 10 years till. You better quit, you're not making no money.
Yeah.
So I quit because I told Joe, go talk to that Northern Air, see if they could help sponsor by bringing their stuff home.
Yeah.
So.
Well, obviously you did it for your love of dogs and the trail and something, not for the money.
No. And I'm still broke today.
What do you think, has there been a benefit to having that trail recognized through there?
What's that?
Has there been a benefit of having the Iditarod Trail run through Unalakleet and back to Caltag?
No.
No benefits?
Nope. I spent too much money keeping it open and whatnot. I have to buy my own gas to go up.
Right. Has it helped the community at all to have the trail there?
Not really. At first, when it first started, first 10 years, the people liked it. The people that go there spent a lot of money. Now they just blow right through.
Oh.
They got no time. They just dirty up things and go leave. not like it used to be.
Yeah, so people used to stop and visit and...
Yeah, for a week.
Make connections with people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see that. That makes sense.
No, they don't. They have no time.
Yeah.
And the trail is always left really dirty now.
Oh, it's, no.
If I could, I'd stop it. I'd stop the Iditarod.
Oh.
They don't take care of it like we used to.
So you'd stop it because they don't take care of it?
Yeah. I mean, they don't clean up after themselves.
Oh. So is it trash or...
Everything.
Dog
trash,
poop, whatever?
Everything. The whole nine yards.
Wow.
Everything thrown into the Iditarod.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's kind of disgusting. When you walk around, you see all that. And kids are playing. They build berms on the slough for dogs to lay behind.
Oh.
And they don't flatten them berms. They oh. just leave them. And kids play on them all spring. And see how dirty they get.
Oh. Yeah, it sounds dangerous too. If you don't see those berms, you could.
Yeah.
Well, I know, like you were talking about the Trail Breakers. I know that Nome used to have a group called the Trail Blazers.
They still do.
Right? Did Laclede ever have?
No. Nope. Too small. Nobody interested in that.
Yeah. And the Nome guys don't come down that far, do they?
No, they only go to that cabin.
Safety?
Not safety, but the one on the hill
where
the wind blows all the time.
Doesn't it
blow? Topcock.
Oh, okay. I think along the coast the wind blows all the time anywhere.
Not all the time. You'd be surprised.
Well, when I lived in Barrow, if it was less than 20 miles...
Barrow is totally different.
I know, but when it was less than 20 mile an hour wind, it wasn't blowing.
Yeah, I worked up there for a while.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just looking over my questions to see, make sure I've... So do you still maintain any of the signs along the trail markers, or are there any of those Iditarod Trail signs?
The Iditarod, Trail Breakers use lath.
Oh, lath, okay.
They bring tons and tons of lath. And there's a lot of lath laying on a tundra.
Yeah.
From years and years of it.
Yeah, they don't use signs that have the Iditarod Trail logo?
Just right there where the trail comes off the land into the Uniplete River. It's got Iditarod Sled Dog Trail.
Uh-huh. And who put those up?
Iditarod.
Oh, okay. So you didn't have to go all along the trail and do any of that?
That's the only place to have it.
Oh, that's right in town?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's... 8 miles up.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know when you guys started that, when you said those first 10 years, there wasn't really much marketing.
No. There's Rick Swenson, Susan Butcher, all those guys used to really complain. Because one time, Susan Butcher was leading Rick Swenson at the pass. And they went 60 miles to a dead end.
Oh, no.
And Rick got mad and said, "What the hell you bring me up here for?" Susan looked at him and said, "I didn't tell you to follow me." So they went back down and spent the night there at the trail because they couldn't see it.
Right.
They had to wait till daylight. When they found it, they were just a little ways from Rome.
And then did she win the race that year?
Rick did.
Rick did.
Yeah.
Yeah, so after you guys started marking it better, you'd use the lathe?
Huh?
After you started marking the trail better, you used the lathes?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She's back and forth.
What about, has the resources along the trail, like, have those been protected by the...
The what?
Well, the trail has this historic protection designation, and I don't know whether that's meant anything.
Well, it's all because Old Woman to Swarovski is wild and scenic.
Right, okay.
So it's their obligation, it's their job to protect that land.
And have they been doing a good job?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they have their own fishing game, so that now that people from the village could hunt from Swarovski to Owen on that BLM land.
Oh, okay.
Only natives could.
Okay.
Supposed to be.
Right.
But there's a lot of white cats go up.
That's always a complicated thing.
Yeah. And there, every native is allowed 2 bear per year for just subsistence.
Yeah.
And one on with the permit.
Uh-huh.
So that's 3 per year.
Yeah. So bear's a popular subsistence harvest in that area?
Who?
Bear is popular subsistence food?
Yeah. That's how we make our living.
Yeah.
I mean, we survive off the land.
Right. Well, I didn't know if it was moose or caribou or...
All kinds, everything.
Everything.
Yeah. See, they want to start mining up there, Trump. Yeah. And there's a big gold mine in North River, which is adjacent to our main river.
Uh-huh.
And if they open that up, it'll kill everything.
Yep.
And they got uranium mine that they want to open at Ilim.
Right.
And if they do that, it'll kill the whole region.
Yeah. I know that folks are fighting that up in Ilim.
We are, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm president of the organization, and we got them stopped for 7 years.
Good.
That's why Trump said you natives are in the way of progress.
Right. Right. What was I just going to say about... I just lost what I was going to ask you about. Oh, you've talked a lot about Old Woman. Were there other traditional places in the area that... the trail goes near that are important, like place names or traditionally, culturally sensitive places?
That's the only place I can think of.
Okay.
The rest is just a trail.
Okay. Did they have Inupiaq names for places along the trail?
Yep. I used to know them all, I forget.
Yeah.
Because nobody uses those names anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, just very few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think those names would have been important for navigation.
They are, yeah. They, like in about 20 miles up in the hills, upriver, they have a rock pile. Rock that they piled.
Uh-huh.
They use that as a guide to when they're walking as to where they're at and which way to go.
Yep.
They did that all wherever they walk.
What do they call those rock piles?
I can't remember the name.
I know in the north, farther north, they call them Inuksuks.
Yeah.
I don't know in Unalakleet.
Something like that.
In English, they're rock cairns in English.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure I know the Unalakleet dialect is different than north.
Same.
It's the same as like up in Barrow?
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We can understand each other.
Oh, that's good.
Except for around Nome, Quarrel, they have the Quarrel mute, familiar, but a little different.
Right.
And they also have the, I forget what they call them. I'll think of it. But they're all familiar with different pronunciations.
Yeah. Well, then there's King Island and Diomede, yeah, and they all have their own, yeah, thing.
The Mylans are Siberian Yupik.
Well, right. That's right.
And the St. Lawrence people, the people in Nulato could understand them.
Really?
Their language is the same.
But Nulato's a Koyukon, I thought.
Yeah. But they could understand it.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, that's like the Inupiaq in northern Alaska can understand the Greenlanders.
Yeah, yeah. See. All Inupiaqs come from Mongolia.
Oh.
Yeah. That's an ancestry.
Hmm. So is there anything else you want to talk about, or stories, things you remember from those early days?
Well, yeah, we're into global warming and climate change, okay?
Okay.
And what's happening is the sun is beating on Earth with a lot of heat during the spring, during Iditarod time.
Uh-huh.
And that's melting everything. All those creeks are opening up, and a lot of snow melting. And some days, a lot of snowfall. And what they're going to have to do is think about moving the trail to the eastern part of the United States. Because that's where the snow is. And up here, the rivers, the creeks, everything is getting dangerous. The ocean has no ice.
Right.
And that's dangerous.
Right.
And for them to travel at night is going to become very dangerous.
There are years now when there's been so little snow on parts of the trail.
Yeah.
They've had to change it.
Yeah. You're going to have to either go from Koyukuk all the way up to Hooslea and over to
Shimnak or Ambler up that way?
Yeah. All the way to Kotzebue and to Nome if they want to.
Right. And are the rivers staying frozen enough that they can still travel on the Yukon?
Yeah, it's they find a way to go up.
Yeah.
Around the open water.
So it's just this side, the Alaska Range, through there where there's less snow?
Yeah, from all the way from Willow to Rowan.
Right.
It's dangerous, getting dangerous to, because of water, too much water. And the very first Iditarod, they crossed the Cusco, head of Cusco River. It was open. They had to swim across with their dogs.
Really?
Yeah.
I never heard that.
And so they said, it's crazy. They're going to have to move that trail. Move it up, move it more towards Fairbanks, where it's a little bit colder. So they went to Rome.
Okay.
Yeah. Even that's getting.
Yeah, maybe they'll have to use dogs with four wheelers.
I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt that one bit.
You know, from Willow up to the Yukon, and then you switch to sleds for the rest of it.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're gonna have to start in Fairbanks.
Yeah.
They can't start in Anchorage no more.
Yeah. Well, they have started in Fairbanks the last...
the first time they started in Fairbanks, Mark called me up. Mark Norton.
Right.
He said, we're going to have to cancel the Iditarod this year because the rivers and creeks aren't frozen. I said, no, you don't have to cancel it. Just call North Slope Borough City of Fairbanks, Doyon Limited, and asked them to use their trails, use their land. And if you get okay, you start in Fairbanks. So he didn't. They all clicked and said, yeah, they want it now. They want the race up there now. Because mm-hmm. that's a money maker.
Yep. Brings in a lot of people.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, I remember that first time they started in Fairbanks. I went out on the downriver from uh-huh. town by snow machine, and we just sat on the bluff and watched all the teams go by. Uh-huh. It was great. Yeah. It was fun. Yeah, stay away from all those crowds at the yeah. start line.
Yeah, there was no reason to cancel it.
Yeah,
I told him, you better do what I say.
It sounds like everybody comes to you to ask for help.
Yeah, even dog mushers.
Yeah.
I taught Lance how to win, Mitch Seavey, Joe Runyon, Doug Swingley. They all asked for my advice.
And what advice did you give them?
Lance, his first time he won. He said, Doug, what could I do to beat Jeff? His dogs are faster. I said, you know, Lance, you're looking back a lot. And when you look back, that drains your ego. What you want to do is focus. Focus on what's ahead of you, not behind you. Just keep looking forward. And do me a favor, Lance. Don't glance back. Just focus on what's ahead, no matter how fast you are. I said, you remember that story about the tortoise and the hare? You're the tortoise. He's the hare. You just focus on what you need to do. Just keep going, keep going. No matter how slow you're going, just keep going. When you get to White Mountain, feed your dogs good meat, a lot of proteins. And when they're ready, hour before you have to go, make broth and let them drink that broth with a little bit of kibble. And that'll make them poop. Once you make them poop a lot, they'll be gone.
Right, they're going to run.
Yeah. Then the second year, same question. I said, you know, you're watching him, right? He's going and stopping, going and stopping. Keep him doing that all the way to Nome. Let him do that. Because when you get to Nome, you'll be up the ramp onto the street, and these dogs will come to the ramp and see you, and they know they have to rest and wait. And that's what they'll do. You just keep them doing that. So he did. And sure enough, when he was on the front street, Jeff was at the bank of the uh-huh. climbing up. His dog stopped and rest until Lance finished.
I think we have somebody here who has a question for you. Just a second. Okay. So that was the advice to Lance.
Yeah, that's the second year. The third year, he said, I got the same problem. He's still faster than me. I said, well, just stay ahead of him between here and Ilim. And when you get to Ilim, do something out of ordinary, something you've never done before.
Oh.
And like you don't drink coffee, like put a cup of coffee by you and play sleep, snore real loud. When Jeff lay down by you, make your snore louder and keep snoring until you hear him snore. Then quit snoring and listen and make sure he's sleeping heavy. When he starts sleeping heavy, slowly pack your stuff, go load your sled, go on to White Mountain. And when you get on Mount McKinley, on top. You stop and snack your dogs. Give them broth. Snack them and take off and go all the way to White Mountain. Just take your time. Don't push. Just take your time. Get to White Mountain. And when you get there, rest them good. Feed them good. And when just let them be, let them go on their own between White Mountain and Top Rock Hill. And when you get down on the gravel all the way to safety, push them a little bit, make them speed up a little bit, and stop at safety, water your dogs, and let them sit for 10 minutes before you leave. After 10 minutes, take off. Make sure your Jeff could see you. And I want you to make your dogs run. First, maybe 200 feet, make them run. And after that, let them go back down to a fast trot. And let them watch you climb the hill. Make sure you're trotting along real fast. And then when you get on top, just slide down riding your brake to the beach on to Nome. When you get to Farley's camp, speed up your dogs, speed them up a little bit. And when you get on top the ramp, make them run to the finish line.
Yeah.
So he did that. And that was last time he won.
Well, you said Mount McKinley. Was that the nickname for Topcock Mountain?
No, that's outside of Ilan.
Oh, okay.
The first big hill.
Okay.
Before you start, make your climb up to go over to Galway.
Okay, you guys call that Mount McKinley?
I can't remember. No. Haystack.
Oh, okay.
Haystack Mountain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you know so much to give that advice to Lance, but you've never done dog racing yourself.
I ran dogs all my life.
Right, but you didn't race them.
I raced them.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And my dogs were the best in the world.
So what races did you race in?
The 200 sprint races.
Oh, okay.
I won a lot of sprint races. I know how to make them go.
Okay, that's how you could give that advice.
Yeah. And I started way back in...
Yeah, when did you start racing?
I always raced all my life. Sprint races around.
Did you have like spring carnival races in Iroquois?
Just on New Year's Day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what, you were like a teenager?
Yeah. Community event.
Right. And then, what, were they have sprint races up in Nome?
Yeah, they do. The Nome Kennel Club holds dog races up there.
Okay, so you would go to those?
No, it's too expensive.
Oh. So you just did ones in Unalakleet?
Yeah.
Great.
I started the North and South Sled Dog Club back then.
Oh, what's that? I've not heard of that.
It's Dog Mushers Club, North and South Sled Dog Club, is for all dog mushers to get together and make a race schedule.
Oh, okay.
For the year.
But did
and
you...
I also started the race from Unicleet to Caltag and back to Unicleet.
Oh, okay.
The 200.
Oh, that was the 200?
Yeah, North and South to Portage 200.
When did you start that?
1970, what? I can't remember. It's a long time ago.
Was it after the Iditarod?
Yeah, long after they started. When Joe was there, I started the North and South Sled Dog Club committee. And that was in 1971.
Okay.
And in 1970, Hey, wish. 1978, maybe, when we started the North and South Portage Tour.
Okay.
After I advertised a 3-day sprint race, and I called my buddy up in Caltag, Bobby Nicholas, and he trained for that and came down and was wiping us out, making us look like we're staying still. And the rest of the committee members didn't like that. They didn't want him taking all the money home.
Right.
So what they did behind my back was meet and extended the race from where it's supposed to go to Swarovski and come back down river. That's another 20 miles added.
Oh.
And so that kind of got me and Bobby mad because he didn't train for that.
Right.
And so I said, okay, at the banquet that night. Banquet night, I said, okay, next year I'm starting a race from Euclid to Caltay, $5,000 purse. Mm-hmm. And they laughed at me. You ain't going to raise that kind of money. And my cousin, he said, we'll do it.
Well, you were good at raising money.
So we started raising money, and I went to the IRA, the village council, to use their bingo equipment. And so they said, okay. So we started bingo. And his wife said, had come here to Anchorage. And when she went back, she said, Doug, in Anchorage, they all sell pool tabs and make lots of money. I looked at her, I said, you're my bookkeeper. Order some. So she did. An all quarter kind. That's all she ordered.
You were saying about the recognition that people don't know that you got, you were one of the ones who started the Iditarod, and you were talking about Joe Reddington recognizing you.
Yeah. After the first race was done and over with, he says, Doug, I'm going to give you the recognition. I said, no, I don't want it. I want you to have the recognition. He said, why? And I said, in 5 days, call me. Call me up and you'll know why. He called me up in 5 days, cussed me out. You knew damn well the media would be on top of me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, I knew that. I have no time to spend time with them. They're going to take my time away from what I have to do.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Joe, you just enjoy it. You'll become rich. So he said, okay. And before he died, he called me up, he says, Doug, I won't last much longer. It's up to you to keep the race going. I said, I've been keeping it going all these years. What are you talking about? So I said, okay, I know you well. So, and then when Mark Nordman, the race manager, went to see him at the Providence Hospital.
Uh-huh.
Joe told Mark, don't ever forget, if it wasn't for Doug, there would be no Iditarod. It would not exist. So, and Mark doesn't want to be called a liar for telling people that.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people call me a liar. But I don't mind, you know.
Yeah.
It don't bother me.
You never wanted the recognition?
Huh?
You're okay with not being recognized?
Yeah, it's been so all these years, so. It's just that the fact is I'm broke, not like all these people that made a lot of money out of it worldwide.
Right.
Worldwide people became millionaires in different countries.
Right.
And here, look at what's in the valley.
Yeah.
A lot of mushers here, Fairbanks, made it easier for them.
Right.
What our original intent of starting the Iditarod was to bring back sled dogs to the villages. Snow machines had just come out, and people were buying snow machines and getting rid of their dogs. And 1970, Joe, he looked at me and says, "Doug, just a few years ago, you could walk around town and see at least seven dogs in front of everybody's house. Now you walk around today, there's none. Right. Yours is the only dog team. You have the only dog team here. Now we got to do something about that.
Right.
We got to do something to bring back the dogs." And that's when he started asking me if I think dogs could run from Anchorage to Nome.
Well, I was going to say, by the dogs going away, some of those old trails went away. People weren't using them anymore.
Back then, they had really good breed of dogs.
Yeah, you have to.
They were strong, and they went all day long.
Yeah. Well, you traveled a long way with them.
Yeah.
You had to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They used to go 70, 80 miles into the hills to trap and break their own trail.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, we gotta take another break here. Okay. Okay.
Okay, the reason I'm doing this is because there's been so many different speculations as to why Iditarod exists.
Uh-huh.
There's too many people that claim that it's for what they think, which is not the case. The original intent was to bring back sled dogs.
Uh-huh.
And in reality, it did. It brought it back to the cities.
Right.
Not the villages.
Well, those first years, didn't they have some village racers?
Yeah, they do, but...
not anymore.
It's mostly white people that's running the dogs.
Now, yeah.
Not natives.
Right.
Because natives can't get the sponsors to keep their dog kennels going,
right.
Whereas the white people all have good sponsors. Right.
But those first years, there were native people who ran it.
Yeah, when they first started.
But
you got to follow. If you follow the races, the food and whatever else they have became so rich that you needed this or that
right.
to be competitive. And it took money to get all that to be competitive. Like for me, my breed is winning.
Right.
And if I was to run it myself with all the money that they get for their dogs, I'd leave them behind.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah.
Because I know I do a better job at keeping my dogs going at certain speed.
Right.
And the last breed I had, I taught them to lope.
Oh, okay.
Lope all day long.
Wow.
And to test, see if they could do it for 10 days.
Wow.
I let them run daily, lope daily for 10 days. And boy, that 7-day record would be broken. Yeah,
and I see in the original, those early days, you know, feeding dogs fish,
yeah.
You know, and your old heavy
beaver, yeah.
And your old heavy freight sleds.
Yeah.
Nowadays it's all fancy.
Oh, it's manufactured.
Yeah.
High protein, high in everything.
Right, and those lightweight sleds.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally different.
You don't have to feed your dogs much to give them what they need to go.
So you were talking about not getting paid to do this trail work. What did you do for work in those years?
I worked for post office for 13 years.
Okay.
And I became a cop for 4 years.
A cop, okay.
Yeah. And then I trap on the side.
Okay.
And I hunted a lot.
Yeah.
I eat a lot of wild game food. And I hunted sea mammals to land animals, to the birds flying.
Right, and fish.
But I quit hunting birds, so too easy. It's too easy to get.
And then you fished. Yeah.
I commercial fished, I subsistence fish. I put away a lot of fish for my dogs.
Uh-huh.
I had to learn to cut fish. And so I put away all my feed was fish, sea mammals, seal fat.
Did you have a family you were feeding?
Huh?
Were you feeding a family?
A like dog. Yeah, a family too, yeah. I'd age trout.
Oh.
Age trout, and when I feed them, I give them aged fish, and I eat with them. I'd eat with my dog and eat that fish. They look at me and start just and really enjoy it, and they do more for me then.
Yeah.
They do anything I ask them. And I said, this stuff will make you strong. I talked to her, you know.
Yeah.
And it'll make you fast. I want you guys to always think about going faster than you can. I know you guys are fast. I know you can go faster. So they just sit there and listen. Then when we go, they pick it up. And the last team I had, I only taught them to lope as they were pups.
Yeah.
As they were pups, I'd walk and let them lope. I'd run with them and let them lope.
Uh-huh.
And so that's all they knew, was loping. And to see if they could do it for 10, 12 days, I ran 10 days straight, just letting them lope.
Right.
And I know that they showed me they could do it.
Uh-huh. And you said you'd been in the Army?
I was in the Army.
Yeah, for how long?
2 years.
Okay.
I was drafted when I shouldn't have been.
Oh.
I had tore my meniscus,
oh,
both my cartilages, playing high school basketball.
Uh-huh.
And I told the induction doctor that, and he heard it pop and everything. He said, you'll be okay, we're going to draft you. So I, after I got out 3-4 years ago, the VA went to university,
oh,
and I went to see him, see if I can get something for it, you know, because they looked, they said, it's funny. There's no record in here showing you ever hurt your knee.
Oh.
It just shows that you had a sprained right shoulder.
Huh.
I said, is that my shooting arm? I was an expert.
So, and you graduated from... Did you go to high school in Unalakleet?
Yeah, I graduated in 66.
Okay.
Then I went to Haskell Junior College,
okay,
down in Lawrence, Kansas.
Yeah.
And I graduated from there. Well, actually, I didn't graduate. I chose to go out on OJT, on a job training.
Okay.
I went to Oakland, working for a railroad there one summer, till I had to come home and get inducted.
So what did you get trained in at Haskell? Was that...
I went to auto mechanics.
Auto mechanics, okay.
And never once work as auto mechanic. But I made all these years, all those years during Iditarod, I was always broke.
Yeah.
And I went up to the dump and got parts for a snow machine body, snow machine engine, and I rebuilt.
Oh.
Rebuilding, and that also with the ATV four-wheeler.
Okay.
I rebuilt my own ATV four-wheeler. I never bought one of them.
That's a good skill to have.
Yeah, and all the volunteers that went up that Adirond sent up would use my snow machine or four-wheeler. And one lady from California, real nice, always wanted to haul straw after the musher leave, haul straw so tie up the tarp so the kids could ride on and just watch them zigzag. I said, what you doing with my machine? Going to light it. The kids would just have a lot of fun.
That's good. At least there was some fun that came from it.
Yeah, they used to have fun. That made it fun, you know. People like that.
Yeah.
Very, very few.
Yeah. Well, and you were saying your nephew, he volunteered with the race. So lots of people in Unalakleet volunteer for the race?
No, just two.
Oh.
I had two that always come.
So I was thinking it's a big community.
In 1975, I was up for 1 week straight without sleep.
Wow.
And checking mushers in and out, walking from one end of the village to the other. Had no time to sleep.
Wow.
And then when they finally all left, I said, oh boy, I could sleep for 36 hours. I went to bed 8 hours later, I woke up wide awake. Well, I was mad.
So they didn't have other people, it was just you as the checker?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I had two others, though, that would come.
But nowadays, there's more people who check.
They send their own checkers in now.
Really? They don't use people from the villages?
No.
How come?
I don't know. Got to spend the money.
I assumed it would give jobs to people in the villages.
No, they don't think about that.
Well, at least you guys got some money when you put the trail in 72.
Yeah, the trail breakers.
Did you get any money?
No.
You didn't go out and break it? It was your dad and them?
No, yeah.
Oh, okay.
My job was to find the money.
You organized it and then you put them to work, huh?
Yeah.
You didn't go do the hard work?
No, I had to stay and keep finding more so that they're happy when they come home.
Oh, right. You guys weren't using radios or anything?
No. First I did a rod. We used ham radios.
Okay.
And those were fun. They were a lot of fun.
But when your dad and them were breaking that trail...
They had nothing.
Nothing. They were just out there.
Yeah, out there in the middle of nowhere with nothing.
And they had to bring their own food and...
Bring their own food,
and gas and everything.
Yep. Well,
that's a big commitment.
Yeah, and I really appreciated them. Because they really worked hard. I know, because I've been on that trail.
Well, it must have been important to you and to them.
Yeah, it was.
And why was it important?
Because I'm the one that started it.
Why did you want to start it?
To bring back the slug dogs.
Okay, yeah.
And my dad and his two friends also wanted that. They wanted to see him come back.
Right.
But that never happened.
Right.
It did for a while. It did for a while, but most of them that raised dogs were school teachers.
Right.
They had the money. And nobody else in the village. It cost too much to go out and get the fish and everything else.
Yeah, and snow machines were faster. You could go out on the weekend.
You just put gas and you take off.
Right, and you could go get someplace faster with less work. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm probably tired you out.
I'm not tired.
You're not tired?
I overslept today.
Oh. Well, you kind of answered all my questions about the trail itself and getting that put in and started and importance.
Our very first race, 1973, we allowed two guys in one sled.
Oh.
And the two that finished were from Akiak, Robert and Owen Ivan. And the other two were white guys. One guy broke his leg going down Danzo Gorge. And Joe called me up. He says, "We got a problem." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "These white guys, one of them broke a leg going down Danzo Gorge. Should I allow the other guy to keep running, or should I disqualify them both?" I said, "Joe, we're not here to do that. We're here to see if it could be done. And what we want to do is go ahead and let that other guy run. You got to think about the money they spent trying to enter and run this race. So we got to give him a chance to get part of that back." He said, "Okay, I'll let him run." And that was an ongoing thing for Joe and I. When something so serious come up, he'd call. He'd call and ask for my opinion. Like when Dick Mackey and Rick Swenson finished neck to neck.
Right.
They called me up and said, "We got a problem here with that. These guys finished together."
Right.
I says, "Well, you determine the winner by which leader's nose crossed the finish line. The leader that won go across the finish line with his nose is the winner." So they went by that.
Versus the sled over the finish line.
Yeah, not the sled.
Not the sled, it's the dog.
The lead dog. Yeah.
Yeah, it was, and that became Dick Mackey.
Yeah. Dick Mackey's leader crossed first.
I think it was like 8 seconds.
One second.
1 second?
Yep.
Yeah, that was a photo finish for sure.
Yeah, it was. And they called me up and said, "Okay, we'll go by that ruling." So Dick Mackey won.
Yeah.
There's a lot of controversy there. They didn't know how to settle it. And so they called me. That settled it right now.
Yep. You make the rules.
Yep.
Well, yeah, and I'm wondering if in the villages and places like Unalakleet, if there's community pride or anything in having this trail go through there and being used?
There's been a little controversy with people that own the land, their land selection.
Oh.
And they don't want to, I didn't want to go over their land. But then that's before they claimed that land, it was the mail carrier's trail.
Right.
It was public trail.
Uh-huh.
Between Shetland and Unalakleet. So that took preference.
Okay.
And
so there's an easement, a trail easement?
Yeah, an easement. They signed an easement for that.
Right.
But I think we pay so much to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize that there was private land.
There's
like allotments.
There's few here and there.
Yeah. I'm sure there's Native Corporation land. But okay. Okay.
It's amazing. So much things that we had to go through. But we did it. You know, it's history.
Yeah, it's important history.
The headlines was, "I did ride the longest, most grueling sled dog race in the history of the world. For any race, for that matter."
Right. And I think most people nowadays don't even think about how you guys had to break that trail back out and brush it out and mark it.
All for with no pay.
Yeah. And I said, I know that Dick Mackey and Joe did work with, I guess Dick was flying an airplane and could see some of the old trail. And,
yeah.
But that's a lot of work to go out and cut all that brush.
Yeah. Well, they did from here to Kinnick.
Right.
That's where they flew, here to Kinnick.
Right.
And to Willow.
Right.
And that's where they stopped.
Right. And you guys out in Unicleet, they did it from the ground.
Yeah.
You didn't use an airplane.
No.
How wide did they make the trail?
Enough for two snow machines to pass. So that two sled dogs could pass.
Is that eight feet?
It's about 6 feet.
That's a lot of brush cutting.
Yep. But they did it.
And you said it took them 20 days, is that what you said?
Yeah, 1972.
Yeah. And there were, four of them?
Yeah. Three of them.
Three of them.
It's 1971, 72. 72, 73 is when they finished.
Uh-huh. Does it have to be kept cleared every year? How?
If you go over it now, it would have to be. Because the willows are growing so fast.
Yeah.
The snow machiners are just going right over the willows, not even cutting them down.
Oh, okay.
The iron doggers.
Oh, right.
And the iron dog ruined that trail.
How so?
Made it rough. Not smooth like it used to be.
Well, even when there's snow on it?
Yeah, it's making it. See, they make it into a washburn. Because of their speed and just gunning their engines. We've asked them to make their own trail, but they just want to follow the idea.
Well, it's easier.
Yep, easier.
Yeah, so when you guys put the trail in 71, 72, how often did you have to go back and recut the willows and everything?
Next year. Right next year when they went back, there's some that they had to cut because they grew back too quick.
Uh-huh.
And to go from there.
And they still have to do it every year?
Every year, yeah. Nobody does it anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
But you guys were doing it.
Yeah, we do it every year. It got easier when the chainsaws came.
Yeah. When did you start using chainsaws?
In the 80s.
Are the willows big enough for chainsaws?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
You get big willows out there?
Yeah, you just dig down deep.
Oh.
And cut.
Yeah, so you cut them at the root level.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes them... takes longer to grow back?
Yeah. Yeah.
And are there trees in that area?
Oh, there's trees all over. Here and there. They're not from Caltag, 8 miles out, there's trees for 2 miles. 2 mile long trees. Really big, tight, tall trees. Daytime, it's dark in there.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So, to make that trail, you had to cut trees down?
Yeah, yeah.
Trees had grown in?
That trail is already taken care of by the Indians.
Yeah. Okay.
They use that, they trap down below there.
Oh, so that was, you didn't have to break out that part of the trail?
Yeah.
Okay.
The last 12 miles they use, from 12 miles out of Caltag.
Okay.
They use that for trapping.
Okay. I get it now. Because to have to cut down those trees to make a trail would be a lot of work.
A lot of work. Right. Boy, they're huge. It's unbelievable. It's dark in there during the day. I have headlights.
Yeah, I have friends who refer to those as the haunted forest.
Could be.
Because they're so dark and scary. Yeah.
That's fun, though. The dogs really pick up and makes you mad because it's so bumpy.
Oh. The dogs get spooked by the darkness and the...
No, they just... They pick up speed when it's dark.
Oh.
They trot really fast.
Huh.
Like one time I was going... I was behind the front runners on the 200.
Uh-huh.
They were not too far ahead of me. I didn't have my headlights on. And all of a sudden, my dog slowed down. I slowed down. Boy, I hate to turn my headlight on. But they stopped, did stop. So I turned my headlight on and looked at them. Their fur was sticking straight up. All 12 of my dogs. I went up and tried to pull them. I couldn't budge them. So I lifted them up one by one. Go try again. I had to do that 3 times.
Wow.
Before I could get them to walk real slow. And I got them to walk slow, and I was watching them. Their fur started going down slowly. I jumped on my sled. When they felt me, they jerked and almost threw me off. But I hung on real tight because they started running. It started running real fast. And all of a sudden, something grabbed my shoulders, tried to pull me off. And I just hung on tight. I said, "Don't bother me. I'm not bothering you. I'm just running a race." And he pulled harder. I said, "In the name of Jesus, get off of me." Flew away. And I almost fell down.
Wow.
I fell partway into my sled, which is good. And I got back on, and the old woman was just 2 miles down. And I wanted to stop there to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't stop them. I couldn't get them to turn. I ride my brake. I couldn't stop them. So I let them go. From old woman to Swarovski, they ran 20 miles an hour.
Wow.
And that's a good 30-mile run. And I got on the other side of the tree line, and I stopped them finally. So I cooked for them, fed them. They fell asleep. I was drinking coffee. I fell asleep. 40 below. I woke up real cold. And I hollered, and they jumped up and took off, throwing me back in the sled. Finally they stopped. And I put in my... sled, I just told them, "Stay, sit, stay." And so they did while I packed my stuff. And we took off, and the buggers went slow.
Oh. Well, that sounds like a scary experience.
Yeah.
Whatever that was holding you back.
I don't know. I always wondered, I don't know. But his hands were strong.
Oof. Those spirits out there, those on the land, maybe.
Yeah, there's a lot of them on that trail.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I think that's about all I had in questions.
Oh.
No, well, I'm going to stop this. So
okay.
Thank you.